Welcome to the New Diplomatist Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Garrison Morado, and today I have a very special guest with me from Portugal, Pedro Sousa, and he has agreed to join us. He is a PhD student as well as an expert in Portuguese foreign policy. Pedro, thank you so much for joining the podcast today.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
And Pedro, perhaps you could share a little bit with the listeners generally about your background and how you came to become interested in foreign policy and what led you to get involved in this field.
Well, I've done a bachelor. I've completed a bachelor in international relations, also a master's degree, and now on my PhD in global studies. The first topic that I dealt with a bit more deeply was Portuguese foreign policy. I noticed that when I was starting, that there was quite good research on historical grounds. But when it got to, a bit more contemporary Portuguese foreign policy, linking it to theory, to explaining, just recent decisions and the like, there wasn't that much research, and even more that could actually help the decision maker in a way. So I thought it would be useful to focus on more recent, like the past 10, 20, maximum 30 years of Portuguese foreign policy, to try to include some theory, to try to actually come up with an understanding of why these decisions were made, were they different or similar to the ones in the past. So I've focused on that for the very beginning, Portuguese foreign policy, and then I've tried to expand a bit to Southern European countries' foreign policy as well.
And so that really is a key part of discussing Portuguese policy in general, I would say. Obviously, a member of the European Union, a member of NATO. Portugal is a very, very unique country. It has its own outlook and stance on things, but it is also, broadly speaking, European. Do you find that there's a lot of continuity or consistency between, say, Portuguese foreign policy and Spanish foreign policy because they're near neighbors, or is there a divergence there?
Foreign policy as a whole, especially Portuguese foreign policy or small states foreign policy, tends towards continuity, and that's especially true to the case of Portugal, where many of the elements that you find today, like NATO, for instance, Portugal was a founding member, or the post-colonial relations, and how long does that go, have been there for quite some time. So I think that overall Portuguese foreign policy, and most foreign policies obviously, tends towards continuity. Regarding the case of Portugal and Spain, for instance, both the transition towards democracy, and also the European accession process, which was at the same time, led to those countries which have a story of centuries of disagreements and wars and a number of issues, for those issues to get solved in 10, 20, or 30 years. So nowadays, they're pretty much, I wouldn't say, but similar may be a reasonable word. Obviously, there are different interests in, let's say, Africa for Portugal versus South America for Spain, for instance, or Portugal being slightly more interested in multilateralism, perhaps, than Spain. But overall, they've tended towards being closer and closer. And that's true for all members of the European Union, of course.
Very interesting. And so I think perhaps for a lot of listeners who aren't familiar with Portuguese history, perhaps we should take a step back and maybe do a brief overview of Portugal's role in the world. Obviously, first forming as part of the Reconquista against Moorish occupation in the Iberian Peninsula, becomes an independent country, was always separated from what would eventually become Spain from an early existence, correct?
Yeah, Portugal was one of the oldest, or is one of the oldest nation states in the world as we know them now. For Portugal, the main issue comes with the unification of Spain, because until then you had basically a number of units of similar in terms of size and population within the Iberian Peninsula. When you have a big, powerful neighbor just next door, then you have a problem, and that's what happened to Portugal. So from the 15th century onwards, Portugal had to find a solution to that. And the solution was basically, well, if we can't go to the east, we're going to the west. And the west is Atlantic and the colonial expansion, or the basically what became known as the empire of the discoveries and so on. So for a very long time, there was this ambiguity, or at least this divergence between Europe and the Atlantic, or the empire, or whatever you may call it. So for Portugal, it was always a case of, well, Europe means Spain, but not only means Spain, it also means some messy place that we can't really get into, that doesn't really interest us that much. We may be, and we have to be, concerned about what happens there, but our power, our greatness, let's call it, relies on our imperial enterprise. And it was like this for a very long time, which means that Portugal was a bit, I would say, not really caring so much about European affairs for a very, very long time, which doesn't mean it didn't look into those issues. It just felt them as being not as relevant as its colonial enterprise. And this lasted for quite some time, actually. So from just jumping to the 20th century, what we have is the three main pillars that are today's Portuguese foreign policy: NATO and U.S. relations, obviously, the European Union, and the post-colonial relations. All these, in a way, were already key elements in Portuguese foreign policy. NATO, since 1949, was, well, obviously, it was a way to materialize the relationship with the U.S., but most importantly, Portugal has always been an ally of the sea power, whoever it was. Britain for 500 years, and then the U.S. since the Second World War. So it was in natural continuity in a geopolitical sense. Again, the relationship with Europe was always a bit difficult, but particularly since the late moments of the dictatorship, Portugal sought to get a strictly economic relationship with Europe, and especially with the European Community. It got it, at least partially, very partially. But then with democracy came both the need for development, to sustain the democratic transition, and that was the moment where Europe became essential, and it is now, I would say, the main pillar of Portuguese foreign policy, or the main element of Portuguese foreign policy. And the third one, which is the relationship, the post-colonial relations. So, obviously, a late decolonization process in 1975, a difficult process with a lot of problems to Portugal in the UN, in the relations with non-European countries. But that led a couple of decades going on, and with the creation of a sort of Portuguese Commonwealth, CPLP, to promote Portuguese language and culture, that actually led to good relations between Portugal and its former colonies. So this is basically the background that leads us to where we are today and what are the main priorities to Portuguese foreign policy today, given this dependency or this historical background.
Well, that was a phenomenal overview of the history and those three central pillars, again, being NATO, the European Union, and post-colonial relations. And if we could kind of go one by one through those, I think that might be a good topic for further discussion, starting with the one that's probably the least familiar with those who are of American standpoint and viewership, which is Portuguese overseas relations, particularly in Africa. And I know for a fact that in the Central African region, Portugal has been conducting a very successful UN peacekeeping mission with paratroopers and special forces and so on. And I know that it's not the first time they've done that, but can you talk a little bit more broadly, perhaps, about what does modern post-colonial relations look like inside of that Portuguese Commonwealth?
The first, this new relations were a bit hard to build from the very basis. I mean, the decolonization process, even though part or basically the hallmark of the democratic transition, were very much contentious. There were hundreds of thousands of Portuguese in the former colonies which had to fled. Basically, the same happened in Algeria at the end of the war. So that led to some open scars, or to some scars in this relationship. But in the 80s, and as the situation unraveled, there were economic interests. The civil society in Portugal became interested in the future of those new countries. And so that led to a rebuilding the relations in a more friendly manner. Portugal also became quite interested, especially in the 90s, after the end of the Cold War, on the peace processes in the region, namely the one in Angola, the civil war in Angola, and so tried to act as a mediator, as a broker. That led to an improvement, I would say, of the relations. Until today, these relations still have some issues, with Angola mostly, a bit less with the other Portuguese-speaking countries. There has been an improvement in these relations, again, as I said, from the 80s and 90s, and most relevant since the creation of this organization, CEPLP, the Community of Portuguese-Speaking Countries. Its main focus is to promote language and culture. Again, as I said, it's a bit like la francophonie or Commonwealth, with obviously limited means to act. But it has helped improve especially technical cooperation between these countries and to advance among the civil servants and the like, to improve cooperation. It has been quite relevant. Other than that, Portugal has an interest, but an limited interest for obvious reasons in what happens, well, in the rest of Africa. Obviously, it's a small state with very limited or with limited capabilities. But one thing that has been particularly interested in is in promoting peace and security. Portugal is a net contributor to peace and security worldwide. And one of the ways it has been able to do that is to act in these peace missions, as you mentioned, the one that's going on right now in Central America, Central African Republic. So that is one of the ways that Portugal basically shows we are pro multilateral solutions. We are committed in improving peace and security conditions in the world. We are going to contribute to that, even though it's not financially a very big contributor. It is so with troops, with boots on the ground. And that's been important to really improve the security situation, not only there, but also in other issues like in Guinea, in the Gulf of Guinea. Also, Portugal cooperates in several of these missions, not specifically in its armed colonies.
And so that's a very involved Portugal still inside of the post-colonial framework. And now pivoting to that second pillar, perhaps we can talk a little bit about the region or the area that's probably most familiar to American viewers, but still not one where Portugal gets a lot of coverage on the western side of the Atlantic in terms of media or press discussions, which is the European Union. And the European Union just went through a pretty notable shift with this new EU budget deal that they passed, multi-year budget deal, including, for lack of a better term, a coronavirus bailout package that for the first time allows the EU to raise debt as a super state and not merely as individual nations. Could you talk a little bit perhaps about Portugal's opinions on that and perhaps their influence or input or reaction to this development in Brussels?
Portugal is traditionally pro the advancement of the integration process, and this is part of it. I mean, in a sense, the issuing debt or increasing the importance of the European Union is obviously something that Portugal cares deeply about and is interested in. As a small peripheral state, obviously it has economic concerns, and that's why it was one of the countries that most hardly fought against loans and more about actually grants, so that it wouldn't increase even more the debt to GDP ratio. But Portugal has for a very long time acted as a very, very pro-European country. It has for also a very long time tried to promote deepening and expanding the European Union. So expanding because, well, it was also what happened to Portugal. So being part of this expansion process geographically, but also to deepen the European integration process with euro, for instance, as part of the Lisbon Treaty, for instance, also. So Portugal has always tried to deepen this integration process. Obviously, of course, there are some concerns. Again, a small country, a country that perhaps feels that further integration may mean a dual-speed Europe, perhaps, or that France or Germany lead the way. And so that's also a bit of a concern, or was quite a concern for quite some time, that somehow some countries would advance integration while others would not be part of those exclusive groups. Euro is one of those cases. But overall, Portugal has tried to promote to advance integration, showing basically that, well, it is important for small countries, it is important for new democracies, it is important to stability. And again, it's part of this culture of international law, of international organizations, which obviously helps small countries. Small states are naturally inclined to like international organizations and international law because it's a way for these countries to run away from its small state status, to learn the rules, to abide by those rules, and also to navigate the system a bit better. I think that for Portugal, Portugal is just now going to be to have to hold the presidency of the European Union in 2021. Those moments are also moments where Portugal, I believe, reminds itself of the importance of the European Union. Portugal had already the presidency three times, in 92, 2000, and 2007. And not only, well, the very relevance of that role is key, but also I think it reminds Portugal, it reminds the country of the relevance of the policy making, of the role that Europe United can have in the world, rather than each and every one of these countries individually.
So as they head into a year where they have that presidency, which is a critical function to play inside the European project, you mentioned in passing earlier when we spoke about some of the history of the Portuguese that they had the close ties with other maritime powers, one obviously being Britain, what with the historic Treaty of Windsor and the oldest continuously active military alliance in global history. What is the Portuguese attitude being so pro-EU, being, as you said, of necessity as a smaller state, pro-Brussels? What is their attitude towards one of their deepest historical allies leaving, Brexiting, out of the continent? And what does a Portuguese-British relationship look like during this new era?
I think that Portugal, on one hand, well, I think that one thing is, well, the political elites, and, well, the other is the public opinion as a whole. But overall, I think that, well, Portugal just want to get this done, in a sense, which means that it's been going for too long. While we are discussing Brexit, there is a number of different issues that we can't solve. Although Portugal has had this very long, stable relationship with the UK, for quite some time now, Portugal has presented itself as the most pro-European, pro-integration country, and the UK has obviously not done that. It has opted out a number of policies, it has rejected advancements in the European Union. So basically this has led over time to a bit of distancing, and actually there has been this distancing for quite some time. I think that there is this historical relation, there is this sense, even diplomatic terms, but at the same time there isn't really much of a way for Portugal to act as a promoter of UK interests within Europe. So basically at this moment there isn't much to do other than, well, just let's get this done with. We can strengthen relations with the UK afterwards. And even during the process, Portugal is obviously very much concerned with the economic impact of Brexit, which are going to be significant. There is a relevant economic presence of the UK in Portugal. There is also a very significant number of Portuguese migrants in the UK, especially in the last 10 years or so, but with also a longer span, and also of UK migrants living, especially in the Algarve, in the southern part of Portugal. So all that is obviously a concern. But when it comes to European integration, I think that Portugal already understands that the two stances are just too far away, too distanced. One thing is this economic political project. A different thing is the security and defense project with NATO, with the alliance with US and so on. And in that particular case, Portugal wants no disruption within this structure, wants no disruption on the role of the UK, on the role of the US, on maintaining this umbrella of security and defense together.
So that very nicely brings us to that third point that I was going to talk about, which is the NATO aspect and being a historically significant maritime power, as you said, a nation that is in many senses wedded to the sea and to trade by the Atlantic. What is the Portuguese outlook on NATO, particularly, and I don't mean to plunge into politics, so if you're uncomfortable with it, please let me know. But, you know, in America, there's been very much a rancorous debate about President Trump's views on NATO, because a large swath of even his own party, the Republican Party, still view NATO as a very relevant thing in countering the Russian threat, in countering terrorism, and producing a broader, more global role. And yet the president has expressed his displeasure towards European states who haven't hit the 2% GDP contribution mark. And that has led, from an American perspective, to certain people in France, in Germany, that kind of increased talk about a Europe defending itself more and more apart from NATO, apart from the United States. If Trump wins the second term this November and that trend continues, how does Portugal see defense? Do they want to maintain the NATO structure, or would they be willing to perhaps explore new and alternative, perhaps not replacing structures, but alternative structures inside of Europe with maybe France or Germany and a EU defense style?
I think that Portugal really wants to maintain this as it is. As it is being with NATO, with the US and so on. Again, because NATO doesn't mean simply NATO. It also means a structure within which there is this alliance between Portugal and the US. So it's not just an umbrella for security and defense. It's also a platform for this alliance between the two countries. But overall, for security and defense purposes, Portugal deeply defends and supports the continuity of NATO and will do whatever it can for its continuity. Not only that, I mean, Portugal obviously supports advancements in European Union in security and defense as long as they don't collide with NATO. There has been an issue for the past decade or even more than that. The EU trying to build security and defense capabilities, but at the same time, Portugal never really objected to that, never really countered that purpose. But at the same time, never also letting our European partners to forget that there is NATO, and that NATO is really relevant with all those threats that you just mentioned. So in the case of Portugal, there are a couple of specific issues. One of is that obviously the one that you mentioned with the percentage of GDP. Portugal doesn't comply with the 2% of GDP. It spends about 1.4%.
Which is actually higher than many larger countries in Europe in terms of percentage.
Yeah. Yes, it is. And again, it's a bit, like we were saying before, when we mentioned peace operations and the like, which is Portugal may not devote so much or so many financial resources to security and defense, but it sure does allocate human resources towards those endeavors. And so
well, and there's a new NATO security center going into Portugal as well, correct? And it was a global I believe it was a counterintelligence center.
Yes.
So
that's going to a second point that I was going to make, which is Portugal not only wants NATO to remain as it is, but also there's a second concern, which is, well, obviously Russia poses a threat and no one really ignores that. But it's not the only threat. Or as well as there is the eastern flank, there is also the southern flank of NATO. And that is obviously the one that Portugal cares about the most.
I'm so glad you mentioned that. I was going to try and get to that if we could, if you have the time. Could you expound a little bit on that southern flank concept? Because it's not one that's very familiar to a lot of listeners or viewers in the western side of the Atlantic.
Sure. So obviously, the idea is that, well, no one ignores the threat that Russia is or may be to Europe, or at least a significant part of Europe, but also that there are a number of security concerns, of threats that are on this southern flank of NATO. And obviously, when we talk about the southern flank, the most important countries to these are southern European countries, and then obviously Portugal plays a part. And what we're talking about this is basically North Africa and Middle East, and a number of concerns from migration to drug trafficking to terrorist networks and the like. So obviously, drug gangs, a number of different issues, human traffickers, weapons, a number of issues that address the southern flanks. So it is a bit, it doesn't have a very clear threat as in the case of Russia. It has a number of these new transnational threats, which obviously also pose concerns and should be dealt as concerns. So that's why for Portugal, also for other southern European countries, but also for Portugal, this is particularly important. So not only to keep NATO running as it is, but also to not let NATO focus only or to shift its attention and its resources towards Russia or towards the eastern flank, just ignoring these transnational threats that emerge from the south. So that is part of a concern, and that's also why Portugal wants to strengthen, obviously, this relationship with NATO. And you mentioned one of the elements that is going to be based in Portugal. So that is also a concern, which is the sort of power balance or the attention balance within NATO.
I do want to be respectful of your time, but would you have time for maybe two more questions? Would that be okay?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, wonderful. Sure. So kind of spinning the globe around here, Portugal's notable in most Americans' minds for the discoveries, because every grade school in America teaches about the journeys around Africa and the discoveries and so on. And being one of the first European powers to reach Asia centuries ago. Obviously, you have the Italians like Marco Polo and so on getting there by land, but being the first European power to get there by sea, establishing that first global maritime trade network, it seems that Portugal and Japan have had centuries of interactions. Is there a Portuguese foreign policy as it is disposed towards China? Obviously, China is exploring the One Belt, One Road project, some people call it the New Silk Road, extending all the way into southern Europe. China and the United States have obviously engaged in a large-scale trade war that doesn't seem to be abating anytime soon. With this kind of competition going on globally in this trade realm, but also with China's increasing importance economically with Europe and investments into Italy, into other countries nearby, what does a Chinese-Portuguese foreign policy look like at the moment, those relations?
I would say that, again, being a small state with limited resources, I think that Asia is still a bit of a very small concern, or a smaller concern, geographically speaking, to Portuguese foreign policy. It's not, obviously, Africa has more attention, and Europe, and North America, and Asia is still a bit lagging behind on that attention. That being said, it is true that Portugal-China relations as well have for some time been relevant. The case of Macau, for instance, the transition of competencies to China, this economic relationship, and particularly during the economic crisis in Portugal, the China invested in Portugal and bought a number of companies. You mentioned the case of Italy, the case of Greece is also relevant, but also in Portugal too. There are Chinese interests in Portugal, and Portugal does have a reasonably good relation with China. What it may mean, I'm not really sure if I can already advance a full conclusion or full statement on that. What I may say is that on the one hand, Portugal obviously aligns with the European position regarding, I don't know, even the case of Huawei and 5G. So whatever happens or whatever is decided on European grounds, Portugal will obviously follow that position. On the other hand, this acquisition of European companies, especially strategic European companies by China, while there have been some countries which really oppose this, that's not really the case of Portugal. Actually, in 2017, the French President Emmanuel Macron wanted to implement a protectionist pro-European law, in the sense that to oppose strategic companies to be bought by China. And one of the countries which really opposed that was Portugal. And Portugal had a reasonably good explanation for that, which was when we were in the deepest in the economic crisis we didn't get much help from Europe, or at least that's part of the reasoning. It was from China, or China was the one that actually bought the country, the company that invested and the like. So Portugal doesn't really see that much of a problem in this Chinese influence. At least it didn't for quite some time. So that could be a bit of a difficult relationship, I mean, say. That could be true for Portugal, but also, as you said, for the case of Italy or the case of Greece, where there are strategic investments by China, which is, well, obviously there are concerns on security, on cybersecurity and the like, but then on political developments within China, on human rights. But at the same time, there was this investment. It doesn't feel like selling soul to the devil or anything. It feels like these investments worked, that there wasn't really much wrong with it, that when these countries were in need, the best proposal, the best options for economic relations and for economic diplomacy was from China, not from the US, not from Europe, not from anywhere else. And so makes these countries a bit more, well, not so able or not so willing to oppose the advancement of Chinese interests in Europe or the like. But again, this is going to be a tough position between promoting European companies and defending European companies, and at the same time, well, assessing that there wasn't, until now, at least for these southern European countries, much wrong with this. And indeed, they became a significant part of the national economic life, let's say.
And sort of to close out this discussion, which I could keep going for hours, but I want to be respectful of your time, I would say bringing it back full circle, perhaps to the Western Hemisphere in terms of Portugal's foreign policy in relation to its former colony, Brazil, obviously now the, and for some time, the largest Portuguese-speaking nation on Earth, or a dialect of it anyway, as well as relations with the United States, particularly in the North Atlantic with the Azores and, you know, I'm going to butcher the name, but Lajes Airfield in the Azores, yeah. And, you know, kind of the defense relationship there. So kind of a two-pronged question, Portugal, Brazil, Portugal, America. What's kind of the status of those relationships in your view from the Portuguese perspective?
I think for both cases, first let me speak about the political developments in those countries and then go to a broader view.
Of course.
I think for both cases, Portugal so far doesn't see anything really changing. And that's how Portugal wants it, which means that Bolsonaro being in power didn't really mean any changes in the Portugal-Brazil relations, and the same thing for US with Trump. So it meant more for US with Trump, probably, not only because of this NATO issue, but broader concern with multilateralism. And that's something that, particularly in the past couple of months, I've been seeing every time that the US president makes a statement against multilateralism. In the next day or so, there has been a public stance by the foreign minister of Portugal defending multilateralism. So that's probably it's Portugal seems to be highlighting that as a key issue. But it seems that that's the biggest concern. So far, nothing really has changed in terms of this country's relations, and so don't bother until anything changes. I think that near future, well, the case of Brazil is one of the most relevant and again most difficult in that way, because going back to the post-colonial relations that we discussed and this sort of Portuguese Commonwealth, one of the main concerns was obviously that it wasn't, or to show that it wasn't, a Portuguese neo-colonial endeavor. And indeed, Brazil was involved in its creation, and it's obviously the most important member in this. At the same time, while it promotes the organization, it really prefers bilateral relations, especially with Angola and Mozambique and the like, because obviously it's a stronger power. So this brings here a possibility, the creation of the organization, the improvement of the relations within these Portuguese-speaking countries, but then a limited promise, let's say. A limited promise because whenever there's a chance to, well, it's called multilateral or bilateral. Brazil tends to go bilateral, except for a few cases, and specifically during the Lula presidency, it seemed to prefer bilateral relations. For the case of the U.S., the issues are a bit different, I would say. Obviously, the Trump's presidency is a concern for all these issues that we have discussed, NATO, the relations with Russia, relations with the European Union, this economic stance towards China, multilateralism overall, and also the largest military base that you also mentioned. I think that Portugal doesn't really have an interest on... I may be saying this a bit too much, but Portugal doesn't really have an interest on any of these things really changing. The best ally for Portugal is the US, and that's been good for Portugal on strategic, on geopolitical grounds for quite some time. It doesn't really want to change that. It doesn't really want to change any of this. And so the main issue for Portugal will be not the divergence with China, I would say, but what if the US and Europe sort of break up, even on economic and political grounds, but most importantly, on security and defense grounds. And this is a concern because when there is a security and defense issue that is not consensual in Europe, Portugal follows the US stance, not the European stance. An example of this is the Iraq War. The Iraq War was a key example of a divergence between the US and its European partners. Europe was divided, but specifically the case of Portugal, Portugal was the first or among the first to show its support towards the invasion of Iraq. And so whenever there is this doubt in security and defense issues between the US stance and the European stance, usually the French or the German, Portugal tends to prefer, or always prefers, the US stance, which means that there is a deeper issue lying here, and that this is a significant concern, even though Portugal may not show it, even though it may not be on the newspapers, on public discussions and the like. This is, I believe, the most important discussion or the most important issue regarding relations with the US. Is what happens if NATO doesn't break down, if the US wants to take unilateral action on this or on that, if it wants to do this or that in security and defense, how does Europe act upon it, and where Portugal will stand upon it? I think that Portugal will try its best to continue to be this sort of glue, this transatlantic glue, as the UK is, of course, to try to keep it together, to keep a single position, a single stance. When that is not possible, usually it prefers aligning with US. The main concern is if this agreement becomes more and more relevant, more and more significant, if over time there are greater disagreements about how to act, where to act in terms of security and defense. If that occurs, that may be a problem for Portuguese foreign policy to solve. But I don't really see, at least until this moment, a different position or a change of heart for Portugal, again, because of these geopolitical broader constraints that make up Portuguese foreign policy as it is today.
Well, unfortunately, I'm afraid we're probably out of time for the day, but I wanted to say, Pedro, thank you so much for coming on and for explaining such a vast amount of information in a short amount of time. I was fascinated, enjoyed every minute of it. I know our listeners will as well. And thanks so much for being on the New Diplomatist podcast.
Thank you. Thank you so much for inviting me.